Recently, we recorded a special episode on the Celtic Tiger years of Irish rallying. And one thing kept being mentioned again and again. We kept going back to talking about RPM Motorsport, the TV show. So we felt it was only fitting and right to get the man himself on to talk to us here on this podcast. The man who brought the action to our living rooms down through the years, and arguably the voice of Irish motorsport for a certain generation. It's a pleasure to welcome onto the podcast the man himself, Mr. Plum Tyndall. Plum, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Plum, can you give us a brief summary of your background and how you got involved and interested in the sport?
I have to blame my mother, I think, for it, because she was a great car enthusiast, and she was a real pioneer, because rumour has it, I've never been able to prove it, that she was the first woman ever to hold a driving licence in County Longford. But she used to drive her father around the place. He was a clergyman who lived down in County Longford. And she used to drive him around in a bullnose Morris 8, which was a famous sort of old vintage car. So underpowered that when they came to a hill, they used to have to reverse up it, because that was a lower gear in that, you know. But she loved it. And my father hated it. He had no interest in it whatsoever in motoring. I always collected dinkies. I had a massive collection of dinkies, no other toys. And then one sort of glorious day of the epiphany for me was I walked into a bookshop in Sligo, where I was living at the time. And there was a cancelled Autosport. And I said to my mum, I said, look, don't want any comics anymore. I want that. And I started avidly reading Autosport from that moment on. Stirling Moss was on the front cover in a 250F Maserati at Monza. And inside that book was a report on a race meeting at down in County Down, and also a preview of the Dundrod TT. So it had a real strong Irish connection. And then I went to boarding school in Enniskillen, and in the next bed was a guy called Malcolm Neal. And his dad was a guy who ran the TT at Dundrod, and also ran the Circuit of Ireland. He was a Gordon Neal. He was a big bod in the Ulster Automobile Club. So that cauldron of interest came, and there was a group of about four of us at school that were really interested in it, you know?
It's interesting the way you're discussing the fact that your mother was a major influence on it, and the dinky cars. It's like it's so much that we can all draw parallels with. It's funny because when we recorded the Celtic Tiger episode, I played my mother the intro, and it was the one thing she said that she kept remembering it from over the years of being played in the house at home, but also like the dinky cars. You know, everyone who grew up to go into motorsport, it seems to be a common theme, the dinky cars, you know, and the evolution from the Beano to getting autosport or motoring news, it seems to be a common theme with people. In relation to your own competition career, I believe you raced production saloons in your early days.
Well, I always wanted to race. That was the ultimate goal, you know, but it was so far out of reach. It was not even a dream you could have, you know. So I wanted to get involved. I went to work in London, and I was sort of trainee architect at the time. And I worked for 4 years in London, and I spent every weekend going to a race meeting. And it was brilliant, you know, because you were within touch of Brands Hatch, Silverstone, Crystal Palace, Goodwood, all these places, you know, and saw the very best. But I put it out of my head. I thought I'm never going to be able to race. It's not a question. But so when I came back to Northern Ireland, I thought I've got to get involved in some way in motorsport. And I gradually got into commentary. Just a little first one I ever did was an autocross, and then a few hill climb sprints, and then eventually Kirkeston. And incidentally, the first day I did Kirkeston as a second commentator, it was an amazing day in history, 1972, I think it was. And it was a round of the British Formula 3 Championship. And people like James Hunt were competing, you know. And there was five drivers from Sweden and all kinds of interesting little stories there. So I learned from a very early age, do your homework and really do your research. And only 2 months ago, I found the old notebook that I'd done all the research on this for. you know. And there was fascinating stories. A guy called McInerney from Dublin, who was the teammate of James Hunt, and because it was the height of the Troubles, they had hired an armed guard to protect them at Kirkuson. And also all the competitors were asked to take either the Union Jacks or the tricolours off their car in case it would cause a consternation, you know. Because I was commentating, I sort of got well known, and I managed to be able to drum up a little bit of sponsorship. And then they brought in the production saloons, which were pretty well bog standard cars off the road, you know. I got a little Cooper S, and I put a roll cage in it and a set of spats on it. And that was it. It was bog standard. And I competed the first year in that. And I raced at Phoenix Park. And I was runner-up in the Northern Ireland Championship. I traded in for Mexico, won the Northern Ireland Championship. And then I got very briefly an X-Works 3-litre Capri, which was magnificent. But I couldn't afford to run it. I just was out of the question. Had to give that up. And eventually I got a Vauxhall, a sort of semi-works Vauxhall. And they helped me a bit. Vauxhall, I won the Irish Championship. That was in 1976. And then I realised, look, I've had my turn at racing. I can't afford to go on. So at least I can get up and commentate and criticise other drivers now with a little bit more authority. I knew it was about, you know. So then that moved on, the commentary moved on, and the BBC heard me at Kirkuson and gave me a chance on a couple of events, a Kirkuson event, and they used to do the Circuit of Ireland each year, usually either the first stage or the last stage live. And they did all kinds of things. They even did a powerboat race. They did auto tests, did hill climbs, you know. So that was the start, really, of the commentary. And then it developed, it really developed when I moved to Dublin in 1980. I was working for a PR company there. And I got to know, well, I had known Michael O'Carroll vaguely, but I got to know him very well. And he gave me a chance to do a commentary at Phoenix Park. And that was 2 days live commentary. And that was kind of a big ask, you know. And it was David Kennedy, people like that, Brian Chute, were helping me. And that went down very well. And then the rumours started circulating that I was going to get the Grand Prix, you know. My God, you know. And so that turned out to be true. And we ended up at the Monaco Grand Prix, which was just mind-blowing, you know. We queued up in the sun for hours to get our accreditation. And Michael O'Carroll always loved a little joke, you know. He got up to the head of the queue and he says, my name is Michael O'Carroll and I'm from RTE and I'm a Catholic. And this is Alan Tindall and he's a Protestant, but we talk, you know. And I thought, my God, what's he saying, you know? So I got my own back. At the start of the Grand Prix, John Watson was competing, you know, and this voice came on from Europe. And it said, bit for level, Mr. O'Carroll. And Michael said, well, here we are at the playground of the Western Road. Thank you, Mr. O'Carroll. Mr. Tindall, I said, I'm very disappointed because the first Protestant, John Watson's only on the sixth row of the grid. Michael says, you can't say that. And I said, Michael, that's one all. And we've been firm friends ever since.
Yeah, it's the stories like that really make the memories worthwhile. I do believe there's a story that did the rounds. You might tell us. Also involving a Capri and a certain world champion from Scotland.
Yeah, we there was a little motor magazine up here called Wheels, and they paid you nothing, but you did get the odd little trip, which was really the incentive. And we took over a car, it was a return press car, back to Glasgow for the Glasgow Motor Show. And while we were there, we got an invitation from Ford to go across to Edinburgh, to Ingilston, for the launch of the RS2000, the Mark I RS2000, and the 3100 Capri, which was a sort of development of the 3-litre Capri. There were two 3100 Capris and there was 12 RS2000s. So we spun around in the RS2000s for quite a while, and I was racing at the time, so it was reasonably sharp. And then we had to queue up and queue up for the Capri. Jackie Stewart was in one of them, And he was doing his formula finesse, you know, how to be smooth, you know, in a racing car. And I was in the other one, and Sammy Hamill, the Belfast Telegraph motoring correspondent, he was the passenger with me. And after about three laps, we came up on the other Capri, coming down the straight and into the hairpin. And I said, Sammy, I am never going to get the chance to pass a current world champion in a similar car on a racetrack in my life. And Sammy says, go for it. So down the inside, cross the curbs, sideways out and away. And what I didn't know is that Jackie Stewart had a camera crew with him in the car. And he was doing this whole spiel about smoothness, you know. And he says, and now we're coming down into the hairpin here. He says, this is where we do formula finesse, progressive deceleration. And at that minute, the other yellow Capri goes past his window. Cameraman pans around, gets me going over the curbs, sideways out of the thing. And Jackie says, that is not the way to do it. And it was on Scottish television that night. You've got to remember that racing in Ireland was at really high level. You had Formula Atlantic and you had great stars like John Watson, Brian Nelson, Tommy Reid, John Pollock. And then, of course, the development of Formula Ford and the development of Crosley cars brought so many young talents into it. You know, Eddie Jordan, Derek Daly, David Kennedy, of course, the infamous Tommy Byrne, all those guys, and they were brilliant. If you could win in Ireland, you could win in England, you know. So when they went across the water, they had a very good account of themselves, all of them. And so then we got the RTE started doing the two-day broadcast on the Leinster Trophy at Mundello. And that was for the Leinster Trophy, which was had great names in it, like John Watson, Mike Hawthorne, people like that on it, you know. And with the EFTA, it was round of the European Formula Drivers Association. And that brought in Ayrton Senna and a lot of big names over a number of years. And that's where we ended up commentating on Ayrton. I actually interviewed him at Mandela that day, interviewed him later at Monaco when he had got his first pole position, and then later again at Spa for Eurosport when he'd done the big deal with Ron Dennis, the biggest deal at the time in the history of Formula One. So I met the man twice. No time except the last time was he particularly interested in talking to me. He'd other things on his mind.
Like you mentioned there, in the early to mid RTE, we're starting to show more motorsport, and that also coincided with the Rothmans era with the Circuit of Ireland. And RTE and UTV showed nightly coverage for five nights of the circuit, and it brought the sport to a new level, it could be argued. How did this all come about?
Again, the man we got to really shake hands with on that one is Michael O'Carroll. He had seen the BBC's coverage of the RAC rally, which was pioneering in its way. To remember, we'd gone from film to videotape, and that made everything much more possible. It was much more instant, easier to edit. And so things like same-day coverage and all that stuff was really coming in. Michael had seen the BBC coverage, wasn't particularly impressed with it, and thought, good old Michael, as he always does, I could do better than that. And at the time, Rothmans was coming in, they were sponsoring the circuit. So there was money about, and there was a very progressive young manager of the motorsport there called William Morrison. And he combined with ProDrive, and they were really go, go, go guys, you know. And the Rothmans money, the cooperation with UTV, made it all possible, but it was amazing. I mean, we had helicopters in the air, ferrying tapes back, motorcycle couriers. We had two lots of producers, directors and reporters, a UTV and a RTE one. I was working with the RTE crew, Gary Gillespie was working UTV reporting, and Hamilton was, he was linking the whole thing. And so it was incredible, and it transformed it, absolutely transformed coverage. We suddenly kind of became household names. We would walk down Grafton Street and people would talk to you and stop you. You know, it just flipped rallying completely. And of course that went on for about 5 or 6 years, Rothman expanded the money. We ended up a couple of years with RTU TV doing virtually every round of the Tarmac Championship. And then it became BIF, Circuit of Ireland, and AA, Circuit of Ireland. They continued to support that same-day coverage. But then that ran out. The money ran out. UTV packed off, RTE. They went their separate ways. And I saw a bit of a gap here. You know, I saw that there's a real interest here. If we could possibly, plug that gap with independent production, I'd worked on so many productions, and so the fair idea, I thought I'd give it a go. But how do you get the money? You know, how could you possibly raise the money? And so to start with, I persuaded UTV and RTE and the clubs to put up a third of the price each of each round. So everybody in a sense got a bargain, really. And the club, it was either from the club itself or from the club sponsor. So that's the way we treaded that. And that worked quite well for a while. And then things changed very rapidly in terrestrial television. RTE backed out. I had to get TV3 in for a while. RTE came back in. Then they departed for good. And gradually over the years, the funds drifted down, you know, and ended up that nobody was paying for it. Absolutely, it was going everywhere, but nobody was paying. So we had to get sponsors. We had to sponsor everything, the signs on the side of the road, the onboard cameras, you know. And yet there were very strict rules. You couldn't show, I mean, if you interviewed a driver and he had Pirelli on the top of his hat or something, you had to crop that out in the picture, you know. And you know, you were trying to get the money out of the sponsor. They were complaining because they weren't getting enough, you know, viewing or coverage, getting viewing. But, and you were trying to explain this, keep within the rules and keep the whole thing going, you know. As a director of RTE said to me one time, he said, Plum, he says, I don't know how you do it. You've got to keep all the balls in the air and make sure that two of them aren't your own.
That's true. But, like, it was vital in many regards. Like, how vital did you see the role of, say, the innovations that yourselves and Michael O'Carroll rolled out on the Circuit of Ireland back in the days, in terms of you were one of the first people to run with onboards and helicopter cameras, and the nation became more, like, how vital do you see it in how the nation became more familiar with rallying and the growth of interest in the sport?
Well, the Rothmans was... That was the thing that oiled the cogs, really, that their money and those early broadcasts with RTU TV. That's what really made it take off, you know, and the onboards, of course. And the onboard camera was an enormous thing, you know. We used to tell the driver, say, we couldn't take that big recorder and camera. That's far too heavy for the car. We said it's only 8 kilos. It was actually 12 kilos, you know. But and they were very unreliable. But they did transform it, you know, absolutely transform it. I remember...
imagine an engineer today, if you told them that it was 8 kilos going into the car, they'd lose the plot nowadays.
They would, yeah. And I remember at the end of the Circuit of Ireland, the famous Circuit of Ireland, when Billy Coleman beat, with Ronan Morgan, it was a co-driver, he beat the other Manta of Austin McHale. And they weren't the best of friends of the two of them in the same team. And I remember saying to Ronan, I said, that was brilliant. You know, the onboard has made that. I said, that was absolutely brilliant. I said, but there's just one thing. He said, what's that, Plum? I said, he said, there's a lot of viewers have been writing in and said, could you wash the back of your neck? You know, he didn't take that too well.
So he can't. No, not many of us would take that well, no. But with Rothmans being involved, and cigarette sponsorship has always been a sensitive issue in certain areas and certain parts of the world. We seem to embrace it with open arms in the 1980s and in all aspects between snooker as well as motorsport on a broad scale. Were there any issues with how the broadcasts featured the cigarette sponsorship? Because I do remember reading somewhere that Barry Hinchcliffe in BHP Productions were having issues on Grandstand with how they could broadcast the Circuit of Ireland, but with it being sponsored by Rothmans. Were there any
Yeah, there was. I mean, well, the
The
regulations
problems with that.
tightened, and if you remember, the Rothmans cars didn't have Rothmans on them, and they had rallying written in the same style. And there's all kinds of tricks like that. You know, the West, who sponsored Formula One, when they went to Hungary, they put an East on the car. And, you know, there are all kinds of little, and of course, Eddie Jordan had all kinds of buzzing Hornets, you know, instead of Benson and Edges. And they pushed the brand colors and the brand shape so that you didn't actually have to say the words. But we were legislated. We couldn't say Rothmans, you know, in the end. We had to abide by that. There was a lot of rules you had to remember.
It was subliminal, really, to a degree, because people made the association with the colours. Like the amount of times we look at Colin McRaeusman's legacy, and if you actually think back, it never actually said Rothmans on it on the bulk of the footage that we're so familiar with looking at.
We were on a local level. Our big difficulty was onboard cameras. Now, onboard cameras cost us money to put in, and so we had to sort of charge a driver to take it. But then he would want a sponsor on the side. But we had to. It was very strict the size of that sticker was allowed, you know. So that was a difficulty.
Yeah, I suppose everyone's just trying to maximize the brand exposure that they can get. But the 80s saw some fantastic rallying come to this country. And with that, some of the great icons and legends of the sport came to Ireland with it. Names like Henry Toivonen, Ari Vatanen, Walter Rahill, Hannu Mäkelä, Stig Blomqvist, Michel Mouton, Jimmy McRae, Russell Brooks. We could go on, we could list, you know. It'd be like a phone book of names. There's that many. I'm sure you've some great tales of many of these heroes and the impressions they left on you.
Well, absolutely. I mean, of course, the circuit, the Ulster, were both rounds of the British Championship, and that's really what brought the big names, you know. Henry Toivonen, people always ask me, who was the fastest driver I ever saw in action? And I would say Henry Toivonen. I wasn't there the weekend that Walter Rahill came to Ulster. Unfortunately, didn't see that, but I've seen the footage, and my goodness, was he something else? And of course, we had the privilege of having him as a guest of one of our Deja Vus recently. What an amazing man. But I mean, it was such a high level. But of course, a great story for us was the local boys were pacing them, you know? The Fishers and the McHales and the Mahers, and those guys were right up there with them, you know? And that was pretty amazing when you think back of it against works cars, you know? That's what made the story, really. You know, our own heroes. And of course, Billy Coleman, you know, the ultimate Irish underdog, you know, who had all the attributes. He could go like stink. His car was tatty. He was a terminally shy. And, you know, so people loved him, you know, and, a bit like Eamon Boland in latter years, you know, who would run a mile from a microphone, or Stephen Finlay. They were so camera shy, it was unbelievable.
There's a remarkable piece of footage. I think Fergus McAnellan at Rally Retro shared it in the last couple of years of Billy and Ronan Morgan on the Late Late Show at Gay Byrne in the run in to the Circuit of Ireland. And it's amazing to watch someone who has a reputation for being so camera shy, as you put it, but how well the two guys come across and how. What a great image and representation for the sport they were.
You see, Billy's a really intelligent man, you know, and he's got real hidden depths, and you know, he might be quiet, but he's thinking all the time, and he's a sharp businessman in that sense too. And he would listen very carefully to what you said about him in commentary, and that was a thing you had to be careful over the years. You were middle of the road. You weren't going to. I always said to the drivers, you've got to take it warts and all. I'm going to say it as I see it. I'm not going to do plagiarisms. If you're good, I'll tell you you're good. If you're bad, I'll tell you you're rotten, you know? And so they all ended up, thankfully, great friends. But they had to take the rough with the smooth with it at times. And there were certain phrases that I used that to this day, Billy came back to me and he says, you said one time, Plum and Donegal in the metro, that the car was dancing on the road. What did you mean by that? And I said, it was so much on the limit. It was just beautiful to watch. And conversely, I always regret it in hindsight. I was a bit unfair to Austin McHale, the famous time when Billy Coleman beat him on the circuit, which I referred to earlier. When they came out of Donegal after the breakfast halt, Austin had virtually the rally won. He just got to get to Belfast. And on the second stage, first stage, Billy never went in for breakfast. He went round the back and he just thought about it. And the first stage out, he blitzed Austin and he reduced the lead by about half. And the next stage, Austin blew up, you know. And I thought, this is a classic Billy, you know, put the pressure on, Austin caves under the pressure. It wasn't true. It looked like it, but it wasn't true. What had happened, Austin had hit a manhole cover or something and damaged the engine. And he was terribly disappointed. And he'll still bring that up to this day. We're the best of friends, but he'll still bring that up today. They remember these things, you know?
Yeah, people do tend to remember when you say something about them. They don't let it go sometimes. That's why we're trying to be as careful as we can at times with this podcast. Can't afford solicitors here, unfortunately. But I suppose even with that, like, you have drivers of that caliber, McHale and Billy Coleman, and subsequent years there was so many more rivalries and how they transpired. You know, was it a case where almost the TV coverage almost fueled the rivalry?
Well, I suppose so, a bit, yes. You know, there was very lean years after the Group B, fabulous years. The Group 2 years were very lean. And it was only Austin, it was the rivalry between Austin McHale and Bernie Fisher that kept rallying alive in those years. And they were the whole story, you know. And they were the best of friends, but the best of enemies on the stages, you know. And so they, you know, there was serious rivalry between them. And of course, when poor Bertie was killed, I had to do the oration with Austin in the church. And of course, he loved Bertie. And it's a thing in sport. Your biggest rival really is the person you most respect, you know? And that happens, I think, in all sports.
Absolutely. Like, it seems to be that, you know, the best of friends, but the best of enemies and rivals over the years too. It seems to go hand in hand with it.
Of course, there were other relationships that didn't work, definitely. I mean, Billy Coleman and Austin McHale, that never worked because, in a sense, Billy stole a bit of Austin's sponsorship in Dealer Opel Team Ireland. You know, Austin had the whole thing set up. And then Billy came in and got about half of it. And Austin was not happy about that at all. And then the rivalry continued on into the racing. And of course, Billy seemed a bit cuter or something. He got the upper hand most times until Austin finally got his revenge in a couple of places. And then the other famous one, you mentioned Jimmy McRae. In the early days, Jimmy was kind of unknown. And we did a series of chat shows cross Ireland, cross England for 1 year called Meet Jimmy McRae, because everybody knew Pentti Arricola, his teammate, but they didn't know Jimmy. And they didn't get on. They didn't get on at all. I think Pentti was difficult to deal with, you know, and Russell Brooks, and he had a few arguments with people too. But, you know, generally speaking, in the heels of the hunt, it's a great fraternity, and rally people will do anything to help each other.
It's a unique sport, because I know this from competing myself, that you'll do anything you can to beat your competitor, but equally at the same time, if there's anything you can do to keep your competitor still in the event, if it's a spare part or even pushing a guy to make sure the car could start, 99% of all competitors will do that. It's quite unique in sports rallying, I think, in that regard.
Yeah, definitely. Well, I suppose it's... The service area, it's a team. They're all teams. They're all the service crews are they all know each other. They use the same hamburger stall, and you know, there's a camaraderie there. And particularly if you're in the same make of car, you'll help out. And if you have a spare part, you'll help out. And very often, of course, people have lent spare part and then gone out of the rally because they did it. You know, it is a good camaraderie. Yeah.
As you mentioned earlier, your career has seen you cover motorsport in so many of different aspects and forms. But recently, you popped up on YouTube on some old screen sport and Eurosport footage working in the F1 paddock in the late 80s and early 90s. Give us an insight into what that was like in contrast to going to Mondello or Kirkstown and the catering and the service parks of Galway.
Well, it started with RTE, where we used to do about 5 Grand Prix a year. And the rest we used to morph tube in the bowels of RTE late on a Thursday night. And of course, you'd wait till you got motoring news out, and then you were the most knowledgeable commentators in the world, because you were commentating supposedly live on the Grand Prix that had happened the previous week, and you've read all the motoring news reports, you know, and you would say things like, you know, Prost goes on driving like this, he's going to run out of tires about lap 26, you know. I remember one time Michael O'Carroll, we were supposed to be in Argentina, and somebody spun off, and Michael says, I'm afraid I can't quite see from here who it is. You know, I just tumbled off the chair. You know? So they were great fun, but they were real cheats. But we did go to about 5 live. We always went to the British Grand Prix. We very often went to Monaco, which was marvelous. And the entertainment, you talked about the entertainment there. Well, when they got to know you, there's so much hospitality in Monaco that they're trying to fill these things up quite often. And if you're a bona fide commentator, they're delighted to have you along. And they say, oh, this is Alan Tindall from Ireland, you know, have another cocktail. So it was wonderful. It had a great time, you know. And then the most extraordinary thing, they began to peter out a bit. But 1986, I had my own PR company in this. I was up in Coleraine doing a job, and I came back on a Friday night, and there was a message to ring this woman, Goethe, in Holland, re-Grand Prix commentator. And I thought, this is a wind-up. You know, this is the boys from RTE, you know. But I couldn't get hold of anyone. And it was from, they called it Europa TV. Never heard of it. So rang on Monday, I thought it was worth a try. And here, genuine enough, it said, you will have your tickets at Belfast Airport on Thursday. You're going to Imola, to San Marino. So I went up to Belfast Airport thinking they won't be there. They were there. And I got to Milan and there was a hire car there. And I got to San Marino. There was a booth, nobody else, you know. And I sat on the morning of the Grand Prix with the headphones on. Nothing happened. 20 minutes to go, nothing happened. And about 10 minutes to go, hello, are you there? I said, yes. He said, Alan Tindall? I said, yes. He said, how do we spell your name? I said, T-Y-N-A-L-L. He said, oh, good. You start at 12:45 or what it is. You speak for 1 hour. You stop. You hand over to Paul Stewart, Moscow Ice Hockey. You stop for 10 minutes, you come back, end of Grand Prix, you stop immediately, and that's it. And I thought, this is the weirdest thing ever, you know? And anyway, the Grand Prix finished, and it was a classic year, because it was a turbo year, you know? But they had this amazing qualifying, where they put in the turbo, the special engine for qualifying, and that was just dynamic. But it was also the year of petrol, they sort of rationed the petrol in the cars. So quite often you would get Prost or somebody spluttering over the line. So in the middle of that day, I think it was Prost, and he spluttered over the line. And then I heard that, stop talking, you know. And that was it. And I sat there for about 20 minutes, and I thought, what am I going to do now, you know? And eventually she came back on and she said, you're good, we like you, you go to Spa. And I went to Spa and I went to Monaco and I went to, I didn't go to the two American ones because I couldn't, because I had a pre-commitment for the Donegal Rally, would you believe? And I went to all the European Grand Prix that year. And I thought, this is great. I'm going to be a Grand Prix commentator. And it turned out they were the forerunner of Eurosport, and there was five nations supporting them, including Ireland. So that's where the connection came through RTE. And at the end of the year, I always used to go to the drivers in the paddock and say, look, can you give me the gears and the speeds between corners? Because nothing like the sophistication of transponders and things in those days, you know? And it was Keke Rosberg on this particular occasion. And he said, oh, he said, you're big in Ibiza. And I said, what? He said, my wife listens to you in Ibiza. I said, oh, yeah. He said, I want to join you next year. I'm retiring. I want to be a commentator. I said, Keke, we couldn't afford you. He said, no. He said, I need to keep high profile. He said, I'll do it for free, just expenses. So I said, sit there. And I ran down the paddock and Keke, a guy called Kees Verhaert, who was the head of sport of Europa, I said, come on, hey, come with me. We've got Rosberg for that. He said, oh, for God's sake, Clum. He said, don't, you know, get a coffee. He said, wise up. But anyway, very long story short, we ended up, the next Grand Prix was in Portugal, and we met his manager, and the agreement was done. Now, of course, his expenses included flying his Learjet from place to place. So there was going to be about $8,000 or $9,000 a year. But I went to Shell in London, and I said, look, would you put up the money for that? And they were sort of quite agreement to this. It was all going to go. But then, of course, Ireland fell out with Germany, fell out with France, fell out with the Holland, who were all the contributors, and the whole thing collapsed. And that was the end of that. But then through John Watson, I also worked for Eurosport. So those were the three Grand Prix.
It must have been a phenomenal environment to find yourself operating in, because having been in amongst, you know, the Vatanens and the Blomqvists and the Henry Toivonens of this world, and suddenly you're equally in working with the higher tier again of, you know, race drivers, the Sennas, the Prosts, the Rosbergs, the PKs and Mansells. You know, it must have been phenomenal to be at that level with it.
Well, you were with your heroes, but that was the wrong attitude. Because it was Kees, actually, Kees Verhaert said to me, he said, you must always believe that you're as good an interviewer as they are a driver. So you must be on the same level. You mustn't be in awe. If you're in awe, you won't get the right questions and you won't get the right answers. And they also have to respect you, because you've got to do your research. You don't give them dumb questions. You know, they've got to see that this guy knows something.
I think the respect object. I think objectivity is respected, you know, the fact that you're able to, you know, form your own opinions and are just, you know, for want of a better word, kissing arse, really. They do respect that, I think.
Yeah. And you had to work hard at it, because you had to have a mole in every camp, in every team. So you could have a driver in one team, you could have a mechanic in the next, a team manager in the next, or in the McLaren team, the guy that gave me the most information was the guy that put on the stickers. You know, and he was a wee guy called Tom, and we were at, I don't know, Monza, I think it was. And I said, Tom, look, Prost and Keke Rosberg, very hard for us to decipher between the two cars. You know, they're identical. Helmets are very close and everything. He said, could you do anything about it? I was joking, of course. And he said, I can't do anything about that like that. You know, what happened between Monza and Portugal, some suit in Switzerland for Marlborough decided they would, the next round, they would promote Marlborough lights. So Keke Rosberg's car was in yellow and white instead of red and white, the one once off. So I went down and I said to Tom, thanks a lot. And he said, what are you talking about? I said, God, I never believed you could do it. You changed the color of the car. No, he said, you know, fun things.
Yeah. It doesn't have the power to change a corporate branding, isn't it, at the stroke of a pen? I suppose the nightly coverage, like you say, of the Circuit of Ireland continued up to 91. And you've been producing the Rally Ireland show in the intervening years. And this evolved into RTM.
As the RTE UTV thing slackened off, they didn't go to every rally. So I was taking up the odd rally that they didn't go to. That was when they called it Rally Ireland. And we did, similarly, Mandela, we called it Race Ireland. We did a few programs. That was my very early programs that I produced myself.
And RPM showcased the very best of Irish rally talent across the year as Bertie Fisher, Kenny McKinstry, Frank Maher, icons. The format of the shows and the narratives that you seem to build into the battles and the reporting kind of crafted their images to guys like ourselves growing up. Like, it was almost a bit akin to the way provincial rugby players or GAA players, their profiles were built to a degree. Like, how do you feel that the role that yourselves and Gary and the rest of the team contributed in kind of almost building these personas?
It was a tremendous adventure to go in every rally because you recce'd the route beforehand and you did what we call the Bible, you had this movement schedule, you had to be certain place at certain times, film 20 cars, move on. And then all of a sudden something would happen, you know, a bit of a story, and you'd have to interrupt that route or you'd send the other team to cover that. So it was great fun. It was a really competitive situation. You had to get there. You had to really get the stories, you know. And we had a great team. They were virtually all freelancers. And if they didn't fit in, they were invited back. So we built up a great deal of friends over the years. And we always had a big Saturday night dinner. So that was the highlight of socially. We all got together. So, yeah, we had people like Pamela Ballantyne, who was a big name up here. She was a newsreader and everything else, but she really mucked in. She was the first up Mull's Gap on at 6 o'clock in the morning, helping us carry the banners. And so it was a really nightly, keen team. The other thing was that, you're operating maybe with two crews or three crews sometimes. The big mistake people made when they were covering rallies was they went to a point, they put the camera up and they filmed 40 cars going past. What we always did, and I got the tip off Michael O'Carroll, move your camera, move it across the road, move it up the hill, you know, at that one location. Makes you look like you have 20 cameras there, and it's far more exciting. And the other big tip that I sort of cottoned on to, rally commentaries, they're all written, but they so often state the obvious. A big crowd is watching on this corner. Now, you can see the big crowd, so you don't need to say it. It's much more interesting to say, wonder what this crowd is thinking. Can Maher do it? You know, is he on the wrong tires? You've got to put questions in people's heads, and that builds up the story, and it builds up the repartee. And then when you go to your service area, then, you're not answering set questions with the drivers. You're asking as the story develops, you know, and not just when we put on sort of, why did you put on those tires, you know, or why did you, and who is responsible for not being there, you know, and could you not have foreseen this? So you were being a bit provocative sometimes, and they didn't always like it. I mean, I can remember an incident in Donegal with Andrew Nesbitt, and we came in to say he'd gone off and he was skulking in the back of the service area, and his co-driver came over to me and he says, don't go near him, Plum, don't go near him, you know, he'll thump you. I got the interview with the co-driver, and Nesbitt more or less told me to bugger off, you know. And so that night we were sitting having dinner in Letterkenny, and he was staying away out in Russell Penner. And he'd driven the 25 miles into Letterkenny to apologise to drive back in the middle of the rally, you know. And so that's how you build up friendships, not by kowtowing. Os McHale, everybody feared Os McHale, you know, particularly our guys who had to fit on board cameras and say, oh, no, not Austin, you know.
I asked him for an autograph once and I was terrified.
Yeah. The fear, but Austin was wonderful because you knew Austin was always trying to manipulate a little story because he was usually smiling, you know, in his sort of a way. And he became a great friend, you know, and still is.
Like, it's funny you mentioned Ibiza and how big you are in Ibiza with Kiki Rosberg earlier, because we started on Spotify a playlist of all the songs that featured in RPM down through the years. And it basically, like, RPM was a huge influence on Morris, William, and myself, the three guys here. We do the podcast in our formative years. Like, I think not just the content, but it was just the style and the music that was used. RT, the scheduling was that on a Thursday night, it used to be late, and it used to be on after a TV show called No Disco, which was an indie alternative music show. I was only about 8 or 9, but it was a very early exposure to that kind of music. So we've RPM to thank for being exposed to this, but and being late for school the next morning, just for the record.
Well, I love music. I had been a DJ at one point, and I loved music. And so I tried to make it a central feature. We couldn't at first because we didn't have the money to pay the rights for the genuine pop songs and the big names, you know. So we had to do what they call library music. But then we were persuaded UTV and RT to pay the library to pay the rights. And you know, so I look back and I think some of the pieces we use, I can remember them visually very well. The Wind Beneath My Wings, when Bertie Fisher won his first Tarmac title in Killarney, Sheryl Crow, Winding Road, a sequence we did in Donegal, and Fisher, when poor Bertie died, we used Over the Rainbow. It still haunts me, that music, you know. But possibly the best one of all was Colin McRae on the Isle of Man. And we went over there and really filmed the Irish Championship. And Colin McRae, of course, was British Championship. And of course, we took all the shots, but we didn't use them during the program. And people said, what are you doing? You know, why? And we included Colin McRae, the sensational pictures. We tie them all together with Steve Hartley and come up and see me, make me smile at the end. And it was really one of the best things we ever did. People just love that, you know?
It still gets massive views on YouTube because I think it's somebody uploaded and it's got 60,000 views. But it's funny you mentioned that. That's actually the very first RPM I saw when I was 7 or 8. My uncle taped it. And it's the one thing that always stuck with me. There's a bit in the edit where there's a break in the song, and it's Sarsfield hairpin, I think. And you just hear the tire squeal as Colin comes around the hairpin. And it just flowed beautifully. Like, there's so many of those sequences that we'd often play, being sad people that we are. We'd send each other a name, the song, name the RPM.
Well, you know that that Craig Bream still uses the RPM theme tune as his call thing on his mobile phone.
I don't doubt that for a minute. I suppose the first series we did of this podcast, we focused largely on the 2001 World Rally Championship, but several of the big players made cameos on the Irish stages down through the years. And you've just mentioned one that I think is beloved by a lot of fans, Colin McRae, but Richard Burns had been over and Tommy Mackinnon. What were your impressions of these drivers when they were over here? Obviously, they were up against our own guys, but what were your thoughts on their talents?
It's like there's professionals, there's very good amateurs, and there's always that divide, and it's a considerable divide. But I thought, as I said earlier, how close our guys got was amazing. At times, but if you go even for 2001, you see we had a panic year because, you know, all of a sudden, how are we going to fill programs? So we had to travel big time in 2001, and that's when we revived the Barbados connection. Maybe talk about that later, but I'm rambling a wee bit here.
Work away.
the year when the build-up to Rally Ireland, Marcus Grunholm in Donegal, or in Galway, Grunholm in Donegal, in Galway, and Loeb in Donegal. Now, we were very lucky. We got permission to go up to Muckish Mountain when they did a test for the Loeb the day before, the Thursday. And we were filming there. I've never seen a works team in such consternation. They had got Ireland completely wrong. They just couldn't cope with it. And of course, that Muckish Mountain stage is notoriously bumpy. They hadn't a suspension that was anywhere close to it. And they flew stuff in overnight. They softened it as much as they could, but he wasn't getting anywhere. And if you remember, on the first stages of that rally, Mark Higgins blew him away. He was 28 seconds ahead after the first loop. And I remember saying to Mark, you're 28 seconds ahead of the 3-time world champion. What do you think of that? And he said, Plum, ask me that question again, would you? But of course, they got that professionally and they got it through, and it was amazing to watch them work through. And when they came back to Cork 20, them and the Cork 14, I think that was probably the most exciting rally I ever saw in Ireland. It was a lovely summer, a lovely sunny autumn. The stages were fabulous. They weren't usually gnargy Cork 20 stages. They were much more open and flowing. And those guys were just immense to watch. That was incredible. That was real professionalism.
Sebastian has often been quoted as saying this, the stage that he did below Kilnamatra, one of the most amazing stages he'd ever done. So bumpy and just so unique. I think they found the terrain, I believe. Marcus Granholm's battle with Eugene Donnelly, it's kind of one of the standout moments of the Celtic Tiger era. Do you feel there was something in reserve with Granholm at the time, or was it as true a battle as we think it was?
Well, it was an entire testing. They were there to test. And of course, Malcolm Wilson, he was trying to keep the blanket on it all the time. You know, he was kept reiterating, this is a testing exercise. This is, it doesn't really matter. But I think as it was getting towards the end of the first day, I think Marcus, world champion, didn't like an Irish champion leading him. You know, that's the nature of these guys, you know? And so I think he went at it the next day. But of course, Eugene was magnificent. He wasn't really used to that car. It was a new car to him, and he drove away. And sadly, he made that mistake of the launch control, which damaged the gearbox, which upset him the next day. Then the fairy tale ended there and then. But it was a great story, really great story, one of the best we ever had the privilege of doing. And there are others, of course. There was a great year, the 25th anniversary of the Donegal Rally and Andrews Nesbitt's first win. And the three of them, there was Fisher, Cullen and Nesbitt. It's one of the finest days rallying I ever saw in my life. They were absolutely at it, very memorable, very memorable.
So, Donegal always seems to bring some of the best memories. I do a Donegal memory that stands out, but it involved Donegal drivers. It was an RPM production. It was based on the Circuit of Ireland, the time that you went behind the scenes with Sammy Fisher and James Cullen to show the contrast of top tier level rallying in Ireland versus the clubmen trying to do the same thing. What was wonderful, what we really enjoyed was seeing it didn't shy away from showing the sophistication of what high level rallying is about in Ireland, but also this is what, the man on the street has to do to go rallying too.
Yeah, Sammy Fisher, of course, was a legend up there, and a very sad end to that story, of course. But I was delighted that his son had that car at our Deja Vu and went through the streets of Rebelton in it, last 2019. Yeah.
And some of the most iconic footage of rallying, I suppose we could say, has come from RPM, the Fisher versus McHale battles on the circuit down through the years, 1998. I actually only watched it this afternoon. We talked about Cullen on the Manx. What was the phrase? There was two rallies. There was Colin McRae and the rest. and James Cullen's Donegal victories. And we were discussing what our favourite RPM productions had been over the years. But what events and drives stood out for you when you look back?
That is really a difficult one,
It would be one I would ask, all right.
Yeah. There was a great, I think it was at 84, the circuit, the great battle between Mikhail Coleman. That was great. But there was also the great battle, you would remember better the year, it was between Bertie Fisher and Austin McHale. And it was a small entry, but the two of them battled the whole way back up north on the Monday. And they were swapping times everywhere, you know. And I remember using a phrase at the time out of the Battle of Britain, you know, never has so much enjoyment been given by so few to so many, you know. I remember that the thrill of that was really exceptional. And of course, we've had some great times abroad, you know, the Barbados years. I mean, Barbados is wonderful. It's like Reading was in Ireland in 40 years ago. You know, it's just wonderful. And the friendship and the camaraderie. And that all came about mostly so I ran a little thing called Formula Friendly. We'd all got to 50. We're all menopausal. And we all decided about a dozen of us. There was more than about 15 or 60. We all bought Formula Fords. And we decided we would go racing before it was too late. And we'd do a little bit of racing, a bit of hill climbing, a bit of sprinting, and a lot of partying. And the accent was on the partying in the evening. So there was always a dinner after it. And we'd been at Mandela, and a friend of mine, Gabriel Koenig, who had lived out in the Caribbean, she brought along this husband and wife team called Andrew Phillips and his wife Winona. And when they walked into the room, we were all stunned because they were white people who spoke like black people. We'd never heard this before. Hello, Dema, you know. And so they were great friends, and that was good fun, a good fun night. But 4 months later, I got this phone call in my office in Belfast, and he said, "You probably don't remember me." I said, "Andrew, how did you know me?" You know, and he said, anyway, he said, "I want you to come to Barbados. I want you to bring a shit hot driver in a shit hot car who's no preference for drinking milk." So we scouted around, and of course, we brought out Robbie Philpott and Kenny McKinstry in the Caliber car. And of course, this was a spaceship landing in Barbados. They'd never seen anything like it in their life. And that made a great program. And great fun and spontaneous reaction and everything. And then that set up a friendship that I went back then in 2001, because we were looking for things to fill programs. And of course, I think we brought Dennis Biggerstaff that year. And then we did a whole, we must have been to Barbados about at least 10, possibly a dozen times over the years. And such friendship and such fun and such good rallying, because those guys are quick. They're seriously quick, you know.
Was the guy Roger Skeet? He was the guy with the 205. He ended up with a world car a couple of years after.
Other Skeet, Paul Bourne, there's a whole gang of them, and they all had nicknames, and they all went well. And by good, I mean, even Chris Meek would tell you he had to go hard to beat those guys, you know. Yeah. They moved on now, the new generation and everything, and our day is out there or past, but It was a great holiday and a great experience.
Greg Cozier is always trying to see if I know anybody that wants to do the events over there. He's a huge advocate for it, but another man that you're familiar with,
big friend, and he's come and stayed with us many a time, and vice versa. And
like we in our discussion about it, we came to a decision of what our favorite RPM episodes were. Donegal 1999 was the one myself and Morris agreed was our favourite one, because you had Nesbitt fighting from the back, a local win for James Cullen, but the music was what really made it for us. And we had our local man Frank Maher up in second, and you basically had all the best guys in the best machinery at the peak of their abilities still. You know, that was one that really stuck out for us. William picked rallies from the Celtic Tiger era, Galway and the Jim Clark 06. They were two ones he really enjoyed. And I suppose, if I had to pick another couple of ones, the year Frank Maher won the series and the 92 Manx, they would be the years that really would be the ones that we would have picked as our favourites.
You got great pictures in the Isle of Man. It's just like the great jumps and the classic corners, classic stages, you know. Always good stuff. But just you were mentioning Donegal and the music. And of course, the anthem of Donegal was Paul Brady, The Homes of Donegal. You know, it just fitted it so well. And the sequence we were able to do through a Melton with the little dog running up through the streets and the, you know, it just to me, that's Donegal. And every time you read, I would have, if I had to do it all over again, I'd probably use that music every year in Donegal.
Oh, it's phenomenal. But I suppose for many of us, I suppose, that weren't living in rallying heartlands, you know, if you were living in, you know, rural areas of Tipperary, where GA was the stronghold, rallying didn't really apply. RPM was our sole outlet of exposure for the sport. And, you know, you'd look out for, you'd see car stickers. You'd always be looking out in the car park to see who had an RPM window sticker, you know. You'd be wondering, who's this person who's also into rallying? But it also made many of the drivers household names in our homes. It did kind of reach out to people who might not necessarily have got an opportunity to see rallying.
Yeah, it did. I think, well, it got a base. When we, 1971, I think, was the first RPM. And it hit a viewership that was almost constant throughout the 23 years. It's hit a plateau. The 11 o'clock slot didn't help it, but you can't do anything about it. That's local television. There's no way. You're never going to compete against a soap opera or something like that, you know. So there's no way you'll really get an earlier slot. So in hindsight, I think we were lucky to have that slot so consistently over so many years. It hit on a very good day. You might get 160,000 viewers, you know. But you always got around 100, 120, you know, thousand. And, you know, it sometimes amuses me a little bit that when streaming and stuff came in and people were saying, oh, we don't want terrestrial television, we don't want this anymore, we want streaming. I mean, if you stream something well in Mandela or something like that, and you have the money to pre-publicize it a bit, you'd be lucky to get 3,000 viewers, you know? So there's a massive gap. Terrestrial television was a massive thing. It's all changed now, you know. I know it's all changed. It's a new generation. But, you know, to answer your question, it did create names. People did. I mean, even recently, Gary Jennings came up to me and they said, Plum, people are saying, do I not rally anymore? They never see me on television, you know. Undoubtedly, it did create household names. And you mentioned the racing too, because there was such a wealth of talent came through in those years. I mean, as I said earlier, if you're in Formula Ford and you could win in Ireland, you won in England. And there was, I think, one place you asked me about in your notes, you know, people like Niall Shannon, and I mean, there's huge talent there, but there was Wayne Douglas, there were so many more. Jonathan McGall, I think Jonathan McGall should have been Formula One. I think he was that good, you know. And Dino Morelli, all those guys. But the best of all that I ever saw in action was Jay Pollock. Now, he was a little bit before those guys. He was a brother of John Pollock. And Jay could step into anything and win. And maybe sit out for 2 years and step into something and win. But sadly, he didn't have a lot of ambition. But if somebody asked me who was the most talented racing driver I ever saw in Ireland, I would say Jay Pollock.
Like, RPM is sadly no longer on our TV screens, and its absence is felt. Like, do you feel that with the volume of sports pricing themselves out of the market onto the TV and going to the paid digital channels like Sky Sports and BT, is there a void that motorsports programming could fill, where, you know, like football is now pay-per-view and, you know, a lot of the major ball sports are there?
Well, I think there's two problems here. There's one is that sadly I don't know that we've got the level of sport, both in racing and, well, certainly not in racing, but in rallying, that we did have. You know, we haven't got maybe such a good show to show. And the second problem is that it seems to be only elite sport, the elite level, makes it on television. You know, Formula One, British touring cars, you know, the support packages to those. And really, what else have you got? You've got supercars in Australia, you've got IndyCars in America, but club racing, really, goes into the either streaming or specialist thing, which is just watched by a minority of enthusiasts, a very thin band of enthusiasts. And of course, they dilute it. You know, the whole sports thing now is you don't watch a program like Grandstand on a Saturday afternoon, which had every sport in it. If you're a motorsport person, you'll watch your dedicated channel. If you're a golfer, you'll watch your golf channel, a footballer, football channel. It's all divided up, you know, and it's not a great big mix as it used to be. Now, in some ways, we're served better like that. I mean, if you're a petrol head like me, you can sit and watch till you're stupid with all the satellite stuff, you know? It's just a change of attitude. Could it work? Could we put back an RPM on Irish television? I know Michael Bracken does an excellent job, and he tries very, very hard to keep it alive, and it can't be easy, believe me. I don't know how he gets the funds and the things to do it. But I don't think it'll ever get the viewers that it did, because you can only see, you can see down the, you can drive straight up to the tape. There's nobody watching Kirkuson. There's nobody, you know, it's not got the youth appeal. They're all off drifting or wet T-shirt parties or, you know, it's a different ball game. And also, I think a motor car nearly is sort of out of the average teenager's reach now. They can't afford it. They can't afford the license. They can't afford the, you know, the tax, the insurance particularly. So it's become a thing to the side. They have other interests of music and videos and, you know, social media and all that sort of thing. It's taken over a bit.
I suppose, look, you covered it there a moment ago, and that RPM always did a great job of showcasing the efforts of young Irish talent trying to break through overseas. You mentioned Neil Shanahan there and Dino Moretti. But also, RPM, in terms of storytelling, you've alluded to this earlier, but it also seemed to be able to convey a drama, an atmosphere and kind of tension that we haven't seen before since. On something like, at the end of the day, it's not a live broadcast. It's a pre-recorded, pre-edited thing. Like the situations like Stephen Finlay's accident on the Cork 20 in 94, and there was a couple of events in Donegal in 2004, the knock out, a start line delay. There was an incident involving a couple of cars. Was it a conscious decision?
You're being very discreet there. Was it a couple of cars blocking?
I'm very diplomatic with this. You can tell I still hold a competition license. Maybe, yeah. You can tell I still hold a competition license and still want to get a phone call occasionally. Was it a conscious decision, though, to pull no punches in those situations and, like, to report them in the manner? Was there ever much resistance?
Oh gosh, yeah, there was a big resistance. I mean, let's talk about that incident where the stage was blocked.
I'm just phoning the solicitor; he'll be on in a minute, so it'll be okay.
I discussed it recently with Andrew, and of course, what Andrew did was he had an onboard camera and he ripped the tape out, never gave it to us, and so he would be happy to talk about that now, I think. Of course, the biggest incident we ever had, the biggest, which was a major news item, not the motorsport news item, was the sabotage incident in the Cork 20. And I still don't think that full story has ever come out about that. We followed up that story. We were right on it. We saw the plank with the nails in it. We were at the end of the stage. And, you know, you were... and a major news story there, you know. So when these things develop, you've got to go in there. You've got to go in and get your story. You've got to go in like one. Afterwards, people may be a bit upset at the time, but afterwards they come around to you and you told it like it was. And I mean, probably the very fact that I'm talking to you here this evening is because we did that and we weren't afraid to do that. And there was an incident at Mondello that nearly got me into the lower courts. And it was a finale of the supercars, which I thought were a great class. I'll have to be careful on this one, but the sponsor Dunlop had been offended because Dunlop wanted to run the supercars in the Phoenix Park and they didn't want to run. And so the finale came to Mondello, and Dunlop weren't going to give me the usual fee to cover it. But I had a commitment to RTE UTV to run the series. So I went ahead and covered it. And during that race, two related people, I'll put it that way, one helped the other quite obviously, to my mind. And I said so in commentary. And that caused enormous offense and all kinds of legal threatening things. So there were times when, and we were only a very small company, with no great backing, you know. We couldn't have, we had insurance and stuff like that, but we couldn't have weathered that storm, you know. So eventually, it's just club racing, you know, it's just club rally. So hopefully in the end, people come to their senses. And we made mistakes. We, of course, made mistakes. We called it wrong at times. But generally speaking, I think we got it right.
The Stephen Finlay incident particularly sticks out for me because I attended a couple of the rallies that year as a child. And on Saturday, we were able to get the local Cork radio. And the drama of what was unfolding down in Cork was breaking through on the radio. But this is about a week to 2 weeks after the event, the TV broadcast had come through. And you really did get a sense of the enormity and, you know, the tension in the air of what was going on. Like, it's without wanting to go down the road of arse-kissing, as we mentioned earlier, but it almost sends being sports coverage to actually, you know, it's like it becomes a drama of its own. To be like, I find that that's quite endearing in a sports show, that it's able to do something like that.
Well, that was, of course, that was a really big story. I mean, Stephen Finlay, who is, again, an extraordinarily reclusive guy, he's been known to pull a rally win to avoid having to go up on the podium, you know. And he had decided, with Malcolm Wilson's persuasion, to really go with the Tarmac Championship that year. And he did. He's a fantastically talented driver, but a nightmare from a commentary point of view or for an interviewee. I mean, he'd run around the back of a van. But eventually, I mean, you just doorstep him and he got it. And we'd battled him down. We'd worked him down a bit. And he was giving interviews that year. And so, of course, when that happened, it was an extraordinary, it was a huge mistake he made. It was a big accident. I mean, he could have been badly hurt in that, you know. And he blew the championship. The championship was gone. And afterwards, at the prize giving at the end of the year, he had a few drinks on him. And we were interviewing him on stage. And he said, what would you say to Kenny McKinstry? I can't use the word, but he'd said, all I can say, Plum, he's a lucky blank. And afterwards in the bar, he says, Plum Tintle, he says, you never interview me. You never do this. And I said, Stephen, I'm not even hearing this. I said, we've been trying to interview you for years. You know, you're the abominable snowman. You just disappear, you know. And so with a few days, he laughed about it afterwards. But he's a great guy, Stephen, a lovely guy. And what a talent. You know, what a talent.
Immense talent. Like he went to the World Championship for a couple of rounds in 96 and 2000 and right on the pace, you know, for a privateer, you know, like he was mixing it in the lower reaches of the works teams. Like he was a very, very talented driver. And I suppose it actually leads lovely. Like Stephen was part of the iconic Michelin pilot team run by Malcolm Wilson, and that's a big brand to have covering your car. And I suppose big brands were involved with drivers, and the raising of the level of professionalism went hand in hand with that. You've seen with Bertie Fisher with the Subaru Ireland deal, and Toughmac with Trukeen McAnallen, the Mobil 1 deals, Andrew Nesbitt with the Cuisine de France sponsorship. Like it was clear that there was a period of time when rallying was perceived as a viable marketing outlet at a corporate level. And how much of a role do you think the production values of RPM and the publicity that you guys could put out and the image, the cool nature?
Oh, I think it had to. We have to admit it did, yeah, big time, because their budgets were dependent on our coverage. And that's a big responsibility for us, you know. There was always this slight battle for what we were allowed to do by the television authority and what they wanted us to do. So you had to reason with them, and you had to make that claim to them, you know, that you could go so far. And we did push the boundaries. We got our knuckles wrapped sometimes, you know, by the television people. We had to sort of back. We had to change sometimes the size of, you know, in post-production, the size of the advertising, or blank sometimes advertising out on boards, particularly in certain places. So it was a bit of a struggle. But having said that, we obviously were able to prove that we're getting enough viewers and enough interest on a consistent level for those marketing guys to go with it. And they're professionals, and they knew what they were after. And Kieran McAnallan I've always been very friendly with, and he would readily admit that Tough Mac really made his business, rally exposure. And, you know, there were so many because of caliber, we were able to go to Barbados because they wanted to travel. They thought that was an interesting addition, you know, to the thing. And, you know, and Dunlop, of course, were the huge supporters over the years for RPM. They were big supporters they sponsored virtually all the Modelo coverage, Carcassonne and Bishop's Court as well at times. And not Bishop's Court, but Carcassonne. And they were the national rally championships, but they were the Tarmac rally championships for quite a number of years. And we sort of handled that for them. And then BIF, we handled that a bit as well. We usually had a sort of sideline of a bit of PR for these people as well to help them to maximize out of the television coverage. So, we did play a part in that, definitely.
It's interesting to see that obviously Barbados gets mentioned there again, and there were some very interesting trips down through the years that popped up on RPM with some unique events. Barbados, obviously, but Ypres in 96, you went to the Middle East, the USA on a couple of occasions. Which ones really, you know, stood out? I know that Barbados obviously has left quite an impression on you, but you've been to some fantastic places over the years.
Well, the Dubai one was very interesting, and that was really out of curiosity. I couldn't understand why these Arabs were paying a fortune to have Irish co-drivers guide them around their own desert. You know, it was as simple as that. Why would you do it? You know,
I must give you my business card for that, actually, just in case. But yeah.
Yeah. And so, of course, we went out there, and Ronan Morgan was very involved, and Bobby Willis. And there were quite a few others over the years who've been involved out there. And it was fascinating because it was a whole different ballgame. It was also the most frightening incident we ever had in our lives on that Dubai rally, we were filming the desert on the first day, and the fast guys had gone through, and then there was a whole class for these lightweight sort of Land Rovers and things. And this, I'll never forget it, this yellow Land Rover appeared out of the mirage in the distance, came thundering at great speed towards us. And we did a cameraman called David Lamrock, and he had it all set up on the tripod, and up it came, and about 200 yards away, it hit this sort of what they call a berm, and it started to bounce and bounce, and then it took off and it went end over end, right over the cameraman. I was beside him, and I tugged him to get him to go left, to go right, and he didn't. He just froze. But fortunately, at the last moment, he flattened himself on the ground, and the Land Rover just bounced before him, over him, and on down, and was completely wrecked. And I thought, he's dead. I was convinced he was dead. And all he got was a cut knee. It was amazing, but we were totally shattered with that, you know? And it was lucky, but it was such a sensational shot. And it was used by Andrew Marriott on his shows in England. He stole it and used it in his title sequence. And it was used twice, three times in Hollywood, would you believe? People got in touch with us. You know, the programs like Sensational Program, like Destroyed in 30 Seconds, you know. And so to use the clip on that.
Things blow up seven.
It was used in a mainline film, salmon fishing in Yemen, right? And these people got in touch with me and said, could they use this clip? And I said, yeah, sure, you know. And we got a very nice little price for it. And this was a story about a guy being posted to the Yemen, bored stiff, and he's in his hotel, puts up his feet, flicks on the television, and he's saying to himself, God, what am I going to do here? Nothing much ever happens in the Yemen. And then next thing, our shot comes on the TV, tumble, 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 and you think, oh, maybe not so bad. extraordinary things like that happen. You know, you get the downside is you get onboard cameras wiped out, you get curb cameras wiped out, lose stuff up in a mountain or something like that. But then you get the odd little bonus like that too, you know.
Like Ypres was something that really opened our eyes to European rallying and rallying on the mainland of Europe. The productions where you sent Gareth O'Callaghan to Flanders, and obviously he went the following year with Liam again to Ypres. We did the opening episode of this series of the podcast. We specialised primarily on the European stuff of the mid-90s to the late 90s. In terms of the rally culture, what was that like to experience as opposed to what we would be so used to here in Ireland and in
promotion of a rally. It was fantastic. Whole town was taken over. Double-decker hospitality tents. In those days, almost instant television. You know, the cars came back after every four stages through the square, up the stop ramp. And as they did, they were showing the couriered back footage and they were showing them off in action on that stage. It was tremendous, you know. And all the service areas around the town. And that was the brilliant side of it. The slight downside about Ypres is the stages aren't that exciting. You know, they're very, very 90 left, 90 right, you know, and there's not much runoff. Now, of course, the World Championship's going there very shortly. And it'll be very interesting to see how Craig Breen does there, because he's already won there. It's a very specialist place. With Fast Freddy, Loix won it when we were there. But and it's so well organized. They gave us a guide. They gave us this guy who arranged our hospitality, arranged our accommodation, did everything for us, took us around. It didn't have to do a Bible or anything. He had the whole thing planned. Took us around and everything. And even when you get to the press room, you get this big long string of tickets, and they're beer vouchers. So that's been looked after, you know. Probably the more interesting story from RPM was when we went with Ian Greer to Luxembourg, and I think that was 2001. And he was totally unheard of there. And it was a round of, not the European Championship, but I think it was actually around the Belgium Championship, although it was in Luxembourg, only over the border. And there was a guy called Bosco somebody, and he had one of the new WRC Corollas as well. And he was the top, he was the dog's bollocks. He was the top man, you know. He'd never been beaten. And suddenly this unheard of Irishman, who they couldn't pronounce the name, they kept calling him, instead of Ian Greer, Jan Geer. And he blew them away. And when we went to interview this guy, Bosco, he didn't want to be interviewed. He just didn't know he was. So I said, had you ever heard of him? No. I said, you know, and he said, were you surprised? And I said, yes. And he was not a bit amused. He was not a bit amused.
That's phenomenal when you look at it. And, you know, but even looking back there to the incident in Dubai that you mentioned and the drama that ensued with that. Unfortunately, in about 20 years ago or so, you had some drama on the health scare about 20 years ago or so.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It was 19, 97. I was, I mean, we'd done all the opening rallies, Galway, Circuit of Ireland, Killarney, and I noticed, you live off sandwiches when you're out on the road, you know, and I'd noticed that I was having a bit of difficulty swallowing sandwiches. And so I went to the doctor and they said, oh, I'll be all right. You leave it for a month, it'll be all right. But it persisted. And on the eve of the Ulster Rally, literally the Thursday night before the Ulster Rally, I went for a test down the road here in the Lagan Valley Hospital and discovered that I had a serious growth lesion in the esophagus. And so that was it. I had to get somebody else to take over. Fortunately, we'd done all the planning and some friends took over the running of the cruise and the rally. And I had to rearrange my life sort of very rapidly. And I went into hospital about 2 months later, 6 weeks later, I think it was. And I was very lucky to come out because in those days, I was told by the surgeon, you'd have 1 in 3 chance of living. It was a very, very slow recovery. The fact that I recovered from that and because of the skills of a surgeon called Jim McQuiggan, I'm here today. The fact that I recovered that made me want to give something back. And that led in directly, not indirectly, to the Stormont Motorsport Festival in 2000, Millennium Motorsport Festival, which was undoubtedly the biggest undertaking we ever took in our lives. We had to raise a budget of 300,000. We had 8 Formula One cars running up the straight at Stormont. We had all the rallying legends, Paddy Hopkins, Bertie Fisher, Russell Brooks, Jimmy McRae, they all came, Frank Maher, they all came. And we had Stirling Moss, all the motorbike legends, Agostini. It was just a phenomenal list. And I just called in every favor I ever had in the world to get the cars and the people there that day. Sunshine, and we were able to give cancer charity £15,000 or something like that. And but that was my payback for being still here.
Stormont obviously proved to be the centerpiece as well for another big event just at the end of the Celtic Tiger years when Rally Ireland came here with RC. Did you have much of a role to play with that? I think you were on some of the RTE coverage at the time, weren't you?
To be quite honest, it was brilliant to have it here. But a lot of us local providers, you know, including ourselves and magazine providers and local photographers and everything, our nose was a bit out of joint in those two events because there was a sort of attitude that, you know, local talent wasn't good enough. And they went for outside providers for virtually everything. And people like Michael and Carroll had difficulty getting a press pass, you know, and, you know, it was a bit crazy. We had great difficulty making programs on both those events. Particularly the first one, we got in under the radar with RTE and just agreed to do just to cover the Irish entrance in it, and just to do a half-hour program. On the second running, a very interesting thing happened. You probably are aware that there was a bit of a mess-up in the organisation. The organisers the first time round sort of pulled out before the event happened the second time, and Motorsport Ireland had to take over. And in a chance meeting before Christmas, I met John Naylor, who had agreed to take on the task of rescuing this event. And he said, look, have you ever done an outside broadcast before? I said, I've worked on many, but I've never actually done one. He said, we're in the real difficulties here. He said, we've promised the FIA that the final stage through Donegal Town will be live, a live stage, outside broadcast. And we thought RTE had agreed to do this in the budget that was mentioned. But when we went into the detail, we discovered that they wanted €90,000 for it. And we can't afford that. So can you do anything? I said, I don't know. I said, let's meet in Donegal next week. So we went and walked the stage. RTE were going to put in 13 cameras. And I said, I think I can do this with 8 cameras. And I also know a friend who's got a small little outside broadcast unit, and we can link it through with the onboard camera provider, who is Microcam. And I think I'll get you a budget for this. And anyway, long story short, we did the ceremonial start in Enniskillen for them, and we did the Donegal town stage, which worked perfectly, with our 8 cameras, all went out live. It was a big day for us, and the bill was 23,000, and everybody got paid, you know? So I was very proud of that day, you know?
Yeah, it's like RPM made it to the WRC for, you know, the
it was lovely to be involved, and it was lovely to be able to help out Motorsport Ireland a little bit, you know?
Right, and it's actually great to see that a lot of the RPM productions are being streamed every Thursday and through RPM Fashion Thursday online, which is fantastic to see. And I suppose, like, our opinion is that we RPM packaged racing and rallying in a way that made it look sexy and high tech and kind of exotic into us. And
in the very early days, the Ballyrain Bugle with the newsletter up in Donegal, Don Wilmot, I don't know if you know him, he was quite a very well known co-driver, and he ran the Atomic Championship Association for a while. Don came to me and he says, we're running a number 120. And you never mentioned the low down numbers. So in the next rally bulletin, I put, and finally I said, number 120, you're mentioned.
One way of getting it out of the way, you know, you did what, just what it says in the tin. But What are your thoughts, I suppose, now really on the state of the sport at the moment? Obviously, putting aside COVID-19 and the current promotion, packaging and perception of motorsport, and is there potential for it to be improved?
There's always potential to be improved, but it's gloomy to say that there's not the same amount of people watching it. There's not the possibly the quality, certainly in the racing, that there used to be. But having said that, I mean, when we're nearly coming up to a year on the last big rally in the country, which was the Galway Rally, and there was, I think it was 18 R5s and S2000 cars in the entry for that, and there was some serious talent. I mean, the age group of the drivers has tumbled considerably, which is very good. I mean, you've got, you know, you've got Cronin and Fisher and the Moffats, Divine, all those really young, talented drivers, you know, and of course, led and spurned on by the success of Craig Bream and Chris Meek in the World Championship. I mean, that was a great incentive. But it doesn't just seem to have the same appeal. It's not the social thing. One of the things that I think is missing, in a sense, is that because communications are so good now and so instant, they've kind of destroyed a few things. You had to go to rally headquarters or to service to get your bulletin to find out what was going on. You went to the prize givings. You had a party afterwards. All that's gone. The life is much more instant. You know, you don't need a bulletin because it's on your phone at the end of the stage. Yet there's no record of that, really. You know, you don't have a shelf full of rally bulletins or possibly programs you may have, but, you know, there's no follow-on, and you don't have a DVD of it, and you don't, you know. I think it's a little legacy loss there. Also, the young drivers, not meaning to be in any way demeaning, that don't seem to be the characters that the McHales and the Fishers and the Cullens and the Donnellys were, you know, that we seem to be missing a little ingredient, you know, that's rallying, or it's a very technical stage, or, you know, it's the same for everybody. All those standard answers, they're very boring. Why don't you get out and say something different, you know, and then spark it off or start a row, or, you know, let's get a bit of excitement into it.
We've often had the discussion of wondering what a sequence from RPM would look like filled with the new R5 cars and the likes of Alistair Fisher and Callum Devine and the guys, you know, after round two, how many points they're on. You know, we've had that discussion. We picked the music and we're just like, you know, if only we could just put it all together. But
one of the big problems is you're not going to get the pictures you got. Okay, you've got drones now, which are fabulous. And that's a huge advantage. If I were to go back into it, I would buy three fabulous drones. But you can't go out on the stage, stand where you used to, move around the way you used to, put your banners down the thing, move them up. You know, just having that flexibility, you're not allowed to do it. You're way back up amongst the spectators, a press pass worth nothing. It's not no use to you. And I would hate to have to film under those circumstances. I really would. And I think Mick, in fairness, does a great job.
Yeah, through all the eras, like, rallying has evolved here, and from Group 4 to Group B, up to Group A, via the F2 days to the Celtic Tiger World Championship car era that we had in the 2000s. What were the best times, in your opinion, when you look back, like, with the most nostalgia, and what were your favourite memories?
I remember, very quickly going through the eras, you had in the early days, the Curly Adrian Boyd battle in the Mark II Escorts. That was very exciting. And Billy Coleman, then, of course, coming in there. And then the Group B is probably the golden years, you know. They were mighty cars, mighty people, mighty entrance, mighty international entrance. It took an awful dive then in the early days of Group A. And it wasn't until, in the latter years of Group A, the cars got developed a bit, that it got exciting again. Formula 2, you can keep. I was never a fan of Formula 2. There were good names that came, but no, it didn't do much for me. And the WRC was fabulous, because the quantity of those cars in Ireland, mostly driven by elderly gentlemen with big budgets and nice building contractors, businesses, or a petrol station on the border or something, but pretty talented guys, you know, really, when you think about it. There was big stars there, and there was great competition. And I love those days, I really do. And I love the legacy. And it was not a pretty looking car, but it was an exciting car to watch. And the Impreza, and, you know, and the guy that came up to me, did you see the Impreza? It was like a tethered down book rabbit and her mad for road. You know, those things, you know, were really great. I'm not so involved now, so I'm not really in a position to either criticize or compliment so much. I do go out and watch it, of course. The R5 cars are incredible little machines, and they're a wonderful piece of technology. Don't move around a lot. Must be pretty hard to drive. But the bonus is the young guys are at it, and it's very competitive, more competitive, I think, than it's been for many, many years.
Yeah, it's been good for the sport. And I think the fact that it's been able to brought a certain energy back into it again, because there was a few years where it kind of was going a little bit fallow. But even you see some of the older drivers now, the likes of Donna Kelly and a couple more of Declan Boyle, they've adapted to the R5 and they've took on the challenge and been able to race these young guys. You know, it's encouraging for the health of the sport at the elite level, domestically anyway, at least. The deja vu events in recent years, you've been running these in Killarney and Belfast. These have taken up a lot of your time in recent years, have they?
Yeah, Dr. Petey Crawford, who was a famous co-driver in his day and lived in America for 30 years, he came back to the same village we live in now, and he had time in his hands and I had time in my hands. And we came up with this format of really the big reunions, just, and they're an opportunity for people to get together. It's not a funeral, you know. It's a nice sociable thing, and they bring out their cars and they show off their cars, and they have a nice run and a big dinner, and it's high level stuff, and it's really taken off, and it's, I'm delighted to say, made a lot of money for the charities that have been involved. The first event that Mo Beattie ran was the 50th anniversary of Paddy Hopcroft's Monte Carlo win. That was in Belfast, and that was a big success. And then we did Deja Vu Circuit, when we got something like 17 former circuit winners, that was co-drivers and drivers, together in Killarney. And then we did the Targa Florio Deja Vu in Sicily, which was a different thing, which was you went out, you flew out, we hired 30 Fiat 500s, put the names of the famous drivers on them, Stirling Moss, Peter Collins, and, you know, so you've got a Collins car or a Moss car, whatever, and you drove the route, and it was a two-setter holiday, really. It was a different thing. And then we did, went back to Killarney because the circuit was cancelled that year, and we did a sort of Rothmans-themed one there. Then we did the Belfast one, which was really the Ulster theme, Titanic, and that was when Walter Roll came. And then Donegal, which is probably the highlight so far, which was last year. 130 cars and big names, and, you know, people going to, I mean, Andrew Nesbitt went to all the trouble borrowing a Subaru, having it wrapped in the colours of Cuisine de France. And, you know, it was magic, absolutely magic. And we had hoped to, last September, a couple of months ago, the Ireland West, Deja Vu Ireland West, which is based in Westport, which we are hoping to do in May, but who knows? But it will be done. And if we keep going, there's another one in the pipeline after that, and, you know, taking it around different centres. And the numbers grow, and the interest in getting their old cars out is just fabulous, you know.
And we're definitely interested in putting in an entry for that when the trigger is pulled to get it live again. And I believe you wrote a book in the last year or two.
Yeah, I've done quite a number, actually. The big book really was Hidden Glory, which is the official history of the Crossley Car Company. And that's an expensive tabletop book, you know, very high quality. And then I did, somebody persuaded to write down much of what I've been talking about tonight, about my years, and quite frank speaking on that one. And then I've done this, which is the Heroes of the Hills, which is really a little picture book of the different winners of the Donegal Rally, which I did for Donegal Deja Vu. And just going to printers this week is one called The Western Warriors, which is exactly the same format as that, which will be the history of the 50 years of the Galway International Rally. And if I live long enough, it would be quite nice to do one of each round of the Tarmac Championship, you know?
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And are they available online, Plum?
Yeah, they're available on the RPM website, www.rpm-motorsport.com, and also through Amazon.
Yeah. Fantastic. There are some nice Christmas stocking fillers there for someone, I suppose, with the Amazon.com or the website. It's ideal at this time of the year now.
Still got all the DVDs for sale, but there's no new DVD this year. We kind of run out. And I'm delighted that that Motorsport Ireland have taken over the archive and are showing those. And they will get the commercial rights then in the DVD sales.
Well, no, that's good to know that they're still in circulation, that people can still go online and buy them, because the bulk of our listeners we're all of that, 20 to 40 period where we still own a DVD player, but we still have a hankering for the 90s and 2000s rally.
A little side effect of the lockdown is there's been quite a revival in DVD sales, because people are probably so bored, they're going back to them at the moment. So
you're saving marriages, Plum. You're saving marriages.
There's a story in that. I was in a service area, I think it was in the Galway one time, and this guy came up to me and says, "Plum Tindle, you've nearly ruined my marriage." And I said, what's wrong? He said, "I bought a DVD, I bought the Billy Coleman DVD off you." He said, and I said, "Well, was it defective or what?" He says, "No, no." He said, "I went home and I said to the wife, I'm just going to sit down and watch this." And it came to 10:30 at night. And she said, "Will you have your supper, John?" I said, "Yeah, please." You know, and I had my supper. I thought, that was great. I just watch it through again. He watched it 3 times in a row, and she came around and gave him his breakfast. He must be able to recite it.
I don't know. It sounds like my childhood years with staying up and taping it off the television. But anyway, yeah. Look, Plum, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you on this evening. Morris and William were delighted as well to get you on. So all we'd like to say is thank you very much to Plum Tindall for joining us here in the Sprint Podcast this evening. So we'll leave there. Thanks for joining us, Plum.
Sheer pleasure.